about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, and your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Devin Olson, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tactical nymphing, Euro style. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're going to broadcast live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Devin a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Devin Olson about tactical nymphing, Euro style. When you stay at Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize, you are only a step away from fly fishing for tarpon, permit, and bonefish. In fact, you may see permit tailing right off the deck of your cabana. At Tarpon Key Lodge, you fish the tides, not the clock, and that makes all the difference in the world. You can fish to the lagoon for tarpon or the flats for permit and bonefish. It's your choice. Tarpon Key Lodge is located on a private island just 30 minutes from Placentia. You can fish with world-class guides like Charles Leslie Sr., or make it a do-it-yourself trip and take one of the kayaks out and spend the day alone. If you're looking for that grand slam, Tarpon Key Lodge in Belize is the place to go. Book your next adventure now. Visit www.tarponkey.com. That's TARPONCAYE.com. Before we introduce Devin, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Devin's section that says Click Here to Register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Devin's latest DVD, Modern Nymphing European-Inspired Techniques. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question will be about something Devin and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and your location, the text on our homepage, and the first person that answers it correctly will win the DVD. And the rest of you, we'll tell you how to get your copy later, so stay tuned. Our guest tonight is Devin Olson. Devin has been fishing most of his life. When he fished against Lance Egan and Ryan Barnes in the former Outdoor Life Network's Fly Fishing Masters in 2004, he knew he had to find a way to compete in the sport he loved. It was serendipitous that he worked with both these anglers a year later after they had made Fly Fishing Team USA. He fished in his first regional and made the team in 2006. The ensuing years have been more educational than he could ever imagine, and he's as hopelessly obsessed with fly fishing today as he's ever been. This obsession has brought dedication, which has helped him to have competitive success domestically and abroad. The year 2016 marked his 8th consecutive berth as an angler for Fly Fishing Team USA in the 36th Fifth Mouche World Fly Fishing Championships in Vail, Colorado. The year prior in Bosnia, he was incredibly fortunate to finish with an individual bronze medal and even more fortunate to have been part of the squad that won the first team medal, a silver, for the USA at a World Fly Fishing Championship. 2016, they followed that feat with a team bronze. Fly fishing competitions have exposed him to tactics and techniques from incredible teammates and fellow anglers from across the globe. Away from competitive fishing, fish have sculpted his professional life as well. He holds a bachelor's degree in ecology and a master's degree in fisheries science. He currently works for the Nez Perce Tribe Department of Fisheries Resource Management as a salmon and steelhead biologist in Joseph, Oregon. Devin, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. You're on speakerphone, aren't you?
I am. Do you need me to get on the headset here?
Or draw it closer so we can get a little bit louder for you.
Here, we'll try this. Is that better?
Yeah, that's a lot better. Yeah.
Okay, good.
I just wanted to fill people in that weren't on our last show, that when we tried to do Devin's show the first part of January, it didn't happen. And I sent out a note to everybody, but I'd like to just fill you in on the situation. But just about the time I was getting ready for the show, I slipped on the ice in front of the house, went flat on my back, crawled into the house, just able to call 911 before I collapsed on the floor. And anyway, off to the about the time we were supposed to start the show, I was in an ambulance going down the mountain. So anyway, all is good now, and feeling good. I just did a couple, three workouts over the weekend, so my back's back in shape, no major damage. But it was scary up here alone in the mountains. You know, you fall down like that, and if you can't get to a phone or, you know, I could have been out there all night laying in the snow. So it was a little bit scary, but we're back at it today and ready to go with Devin, and we have a ton of questions tonight. Very, very popular topic. So we're going to dig right in here, and Devin, we'll just do as best we can here, huh, buddy, and try to get as many answers as possible. First off, let's just tell us, you know, in your mind today, what is Uronymphing?
All right. Well, Uronymphing, as it is, you know, as I kind of refer to it now, is an amalgam of all sorts of different techniques from the different countries that have, you know, lent their own style to the winning methods at World Fly Fishing Championships. Basically, it differs from what we would typically find in the U.S. by, first, you don't fish a strike indicator or some sort of a suspending device like a thingamabobber or, you know, a corky, whatever. So it's purely a leader-only method. We do build some colored monofilament called a cider into our leader so that we have a visual indicator of strike, but it doesn't have the same suspension power that you'd find in a strike indicator. Besides that, our leaders tend to be exceptionally long compared to what most people would be used to. You know, a typical leader for most people who are out there indicator nymphing might be 9 to 10, 11, maybe even 12 feet long if they tend to fish a little bit longer one. But our European nymphing leaders tend to start somewhere around 18 feet, and a lot of us fish more in the line of 20 to 21 feet. Back before Fitzmoosh limited the lengths and leaders, you know, there were guys that were fishing even much longer ones that were 30 or 40 feet. So a much longer leader, and that leader is made to be able to fish at distance, but it's also very thin in general. It's much thinner than the thick butt section you'd find on a heavy tapered leader that you'd use for indicator nymphing. Our leaders are mainly made to be thin so they don't sag and succumb to gravity at distance. Besides that, we don't tend to use split shot or any added weight on our leaders. All the weight is in our flies, which gives us a direct connection to the weight that's providing tension, which increases our strike detection. That's also part of the rules in international competitions. We're not allowed strike indicators or added weight. So that's a lot of how this method was shaped over many years by competitors, is, you know, living within the rule set that we have. And a lot of people would think that's quite limiting, and for, you know, some situations it might be, but as I've come to learn a lot more about the European nymphing styles, I've seen that I don't really need to go back to the use of indicators and split shot nearly as like I used to before I got into competitions. Today, the way we have our European nymphing set up, it's a blend of, like I said, a lot of different countries. We've kind of taken the best of what we feel a lot of the different methods have had to offer and blended them into a hybrid system. Each country still tends to have their own style, but we tend to use one leader, or at least the same basic leader configuration with maybe some different diameters for different purposes. But one long leader and one basic configuration with weighted flies, and then you either cast quartering up and across and hold your cider off the water and watch that cider as it tracks along.
for indication of strike. So you're basically tight lining, or you have a contact nymphing connection to your flies at that point. If we're fishing upstream, a lot of times we'll float the cider and grease it with some sort of paste type floatant, and use it as kind of a mini suspension device where we're just greasing the leader and watching that cider for any indication of a take. So in a real basic, short answer, that's what I would say European nymphing is today.
Okay. So a kind of combination of all the different techniques. Because we used to, I know, like we were talking before the show, when the first show I ever did on European nymphing, we went through all the different types. And back then there was Polish and Spanish and French and all these different, each country seemed to have their own method. But you've kind of evolved it into just one basic method, so to speak, right?
Yeah, I would say so. It's funny. I think largely because of social media and the internet age and the way things spread around so quickly these days, most of the countries at the World Championships are fishing very similar systems at this point in time. I don't know if there's as large a divergence as there used to be, although we all individually still have our own styles for sure. But one of the interesting things that I saw in a lot of the questions that we got was a lot of people were asking about leader angles and whether you're leading your flies, like most people refer to when they talk about check nymphing. For me personally, I don't do a lot of leading flies. For those who've watched the film that you were talking about that we just put out, I tend to hold my leader fairly vertically and get most of my strike detection visually by watching that cider stop. There are other anglers that do fish a little more horizontal or shallower type angle with their leader, where they're a little tighter to their flies and they're leading them along slightly faster than the speed of the water that they're in to try and maintain tension. Coming from such a dead drift background that I come from, I don't have a lot of confidence fishing that way as much. So I have more confidence if I'm fishing lighter flies and letting the flies themselves, the weight of them, provide my tension in the rig. And I feel like I get a better drift that way, and I can usually fish smaller flies. And coming from a tailwater background, I'm also usually more comfortable with slightly smaller flies. So having that vertical angle in my leader is a confidence method for me, and then watching the take instead of doing as much feeling. And I would say that's where the method that we have now differs a little bit from a lot of the Czech style or Polish style nymphing that a lot of people thought about when they think of European nymphing, which was typified by short leaders and having fly line out the tip of your rod a lot of times and leading a little bit. But because of our long leaders, we rarely have fly line out the tip of the rod other than right at the beginning of a cast. And I mainly use the fly line just to strip in line and then have something tactile that's grippy that I can hold on to when I set the hook or fight a fish.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing when you're fly fishing in like the U.S. Championships, how do you score points? Is it number of fish? Is it are you weighing fish? What constitutes points?
Okay, well, basically the setup is that you have a bead of water that you're supposed to fish. You get about 150, 200 yards of water from flag to flag that you fish for 3 hours. And you fish directly against the people that are fishing the same river at the same time as you. So that's kind of your group that you fish against. And within each three-hour session, you basically go and try and catch as many fish as you can. And you have someone who is there with you, who's measuring your fish. And there's a formula that combines both points for just having caught a fish that it has to be longer than 20 centimeters, but you get 100 points for every fish that you catch, and then you get 20 points for every centimeter long that fish is. So at the end of that session, all those points are added up, and it's essentially a combination of the numbers of the fish and the length of them that'll give you your points for each session, and then all those placing points within those sessions are added up at the end of the tournament, and that's how you're ranked.
So when you go out there, is the strategy more to just try to catch as many fish as you can rather than try to focus on any larger fish?
Well, It kind of depends upon the river that you're fishing, obviously, and the makeup and the density of fish and all that. Most of the time, you're trying to catch fish, and as many as you can, and you hope that within that you're getting some large ones as well. But typically, you know, if you get one or two or three more fish than the next guy, you're hopefully going to beat them, so you want numbers. But a lot of times ties are broken by having large fish. And so a lot of times we'll go and we'll try and use number techniques to begin with, but we might come back through with a streamer or something like that at the end to try and target a few of those larger fish that we might have missed by having a technique that, you know, either favors smaller fish or just more on the feed fish instead of those fish that need kind of an aggression bite.
Well, that just brings up a question then. So when you're doing the Euro-style nymphing, are you is it favoring smaller fish or larger fish, or is there does it not favor either? Do you get both?
I don't think it favors either.
Okay.
I mean, it's no different than any other method of nymphing in, you know, the size of fish that you would catch. In my mind, I use it all the time to go and target steelhead. You know, I use it a lot on rivers that have big trout, and I catch a lot of big trout doing it. I don't see that it limits your size. Typically, I think you target different size fish by the water type that you fish and the style of flies that you fish, and that's how you're going to change the size of fish that you're targeting, not necessarily the pure method, if you ask me.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start to roll through some of these questions here. A bunch of questions on rods and whether people can use what they have. Bill in Oregon asked that. You know, can I use my conventional equipment? How long do the rods have to be? What's a good weight for the rod? I'm just kind of combining all these so you can kind of address them together.
Sure.
And would my 10-foot, 5-weight work? Do I need something special? And I think that kind of covers most of the questions. And thanks, Ralph, Phil, Rob, Camilo, and all of you that sent in the questions. So why don't you just talk in general then, Devin, about what's the best equipment set up, and also address, you know, can you kind of fudge and use some of the stuff you already have? Can you get by in those situations? Address those two things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you there?
Eric, can you hear me now?
Now I can.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost you
okay.
For a second.
I'm not sure what happened. Anyway, you certainly can go out with your 9-foot 5-weight or 6-weight or whatever typical nymphing rod that you have, but I will say that it's going to be a bit of a handicap. Typically, when we're European nymphing, we're using rods that are at least 10 feet long, a lot of times 10.5 or even 11 feet long. My go-to rod most of the time is a 10.5-foot 3-weight, and there's a few reasons for both having a long rod and a lightweight rod. As far as the long rod goes, because you're not able to float, you know, your rig at distance away from you a ways as much, you want to be able to have as much reach as possible with your rod. And so having a longer rod gets you further away from the fish and allows you to kind of get under that cone of vision that a lot of angling writers have written about, that if you can stay below or at least keep most of you below, then you're less threatening as a fish and you're less likely to spook them. So a longer rod will allow you to fish further away and spook less fish. In addition to that, a longer rod is much easier to cast a really long light leader Euro nymphing rig because it has a longer casting arc, just simply because of the distance that the tip of the rod travels. You can stay in contact with your flies and that weight on the end of your leader that's doing a lot of the loading of your cast. It's a lot like a pendulum where if you lose contact with or like a slingshot, I guess is a better metaphor. If you have a slingshot and you lose contact as you're whipping it around your head, all of a sudden when it comes tight, it's going to shoot off in a direction that's not where you want. And the wider you can make that stroke and that arc, the more likely you're able to stay in contact as it comes around. So that longer rod helps you have that longer casting stroke, stay in contact, and then you can direct your cast a little bit easier that way, whereas I know when I fish a shorter rod, I really have to wait a long time to make sure that my flies have turned over both in front and behind so that I get an accurate cast when I make my placement. And then as far as a light rod, we tend to favor, you know, 2 to 4 weight rods typically for this method. And the main reason is that, especially the way European nymphing has progressed over the last few years, we're using less and less flies that are, you know, big bomb or anchor type patterns that a lot of people refer to them as. Most of the flies that I'm fishing nowadays are size 16 to 12 and don't have a lot of weight. They're fairly lightly weighted even though they have tungsten beads. They don't have, you know, I'm not fishing 2 4-millimeter size tungsten beads on flies and a whole bunch of lead anymore. I'm mainly fishing small flies, and so those flies, along with the weight of the leader, are really what loads your rod during the casting stroke when you're European nymphing. So if the rod is a lighter weight rod, it tends to load easier with lighter rigs, and then you get a better propulsion on the stroke. So a long light rod is better, but certainly if you have a 9'5" or 9'6" weight, go out and try it. But then if you're struggling with the transition of casting a Euro rig, really consider, you know, getting a 10-foot or 10.5 or 11-foot rod and giving it a go. There's enough companies out there these days that are making, you know, lower-priced European nymphing rods, you know, like the Cortland Comp rod that's $250 to the, you know, Echo rod to the Reddington rod. There's enough lower-end type European nymphing rods that if you're worried about, you know, dropping a bunch of cash to begin with on a longer rod, you can get one that's a lot less expensive than, you know, going to a premium rod that's going to run you $700, $800, $900. So those rods are going to help you in your transition for sure.
Okay. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about reels and line and leader setups. So that'll be next. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service product support. They're best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercast should be. They've been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Devin Olson about tactical nymphing, Eurostyle. So if you'd like to ask Devin a question, just go to our homepage, ask about fly fishing, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Devin, I was asking, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? I know you just published this film you did, this instructional film. You want to tell folks about that?
Sure, yeah. So I guess a little over a year ago now, I started a website called tacticalflyfisher.com, and essentially the idea was to take the competitive techniques that I've been learning over the last decade or more and put them into a format that was consumable by, you know, the everyday angler and would also help competition anglers, and then also be able to sell the products that I tend to use in competitions all the time. So I have a web store there, and I run a blog where I'm posting a lot of tutorials or educational type stuff. But shortly after that, I started that site. I really wanted to kind of get some big projects to distill a lot of the information that I have gleaned over the years and make them readily available to a wider audience that I can get than just through the site, and kind of also attract some people to methods that have led to a lot of success for me and been a big help out on the water. So I knew that an instructional video was a big part of that. So I've got a good friend named Gilbert Rowley, who I went to in undergrad classes with all the way back during my early fisheries days. And he's turned into a really excellent filmmaker who's had a couple of films and film tours the last few years. And so I contacted him and asked if he'd be interested in working on a much bigger feature-type project that was instructional. And right about the same time, I was talking to my teammate, whom a lot of people know, Lance Egan, and asked if he wanted to join in on the project with me. And so we formed a triumvirate that I think worked really well, and we came out with a film called Modern Nymphing about a month and a half ago, I guess. And it's been a really big success so far. We've had a lot of good positive feedback, and we've tried to blend education with kind of a film tour feel so that you get excited about fishing when you watch the film and learn at the same time.
Okay, and folks can get that at, you want to give your website address again?
Sure, yeah. So you can find, it's available at Vimeo on demand. If you just search Modern Nymphing there, you can find it. So we have a digital download or digital streaming that you can do on Vimeo there. I'm also selling it on my website at tacticalflyfisher.com. And then we've got a growing network of dealers right now, and certainly if you have a local dealer that you want to pick the DVD up from, please do if they're selling it, and if not, ask them to shoot me an email over at info@tacticalflyfisher.com, and we'll certainly get a dealer program set up for them so that they can carry the DVDs in their shop.
Great, great. Well, good, good. I hope that's successful for you, and certainly it was very well done. You know, you guys did a great job on that, so kudos to you on that.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah. It was quite the project, and Gilbert did a heck of a job. He put so many hours into that film, you wouldn't believe it. So.
I would. Okay, well, good. Let's talk about, what about line and reels then, to match that rod? How important is that?
Well, so European nymphing lines are a little bit different than your typical fly line. I get asked this question a fair bit, and it's a common misconception. You don't look for a European nymphing line that matches, your 3 or 4 weight or your 2 weight rod. So you don't go looking for a European rod or nymph line that says 2 weight. What you essentially look for is the lightest possible fly line you can get. And the main function of the fly line for me when I'm fishing is, one, to keep me in compliance with the FIPS Moosh rules that when I compete where I can only have a leader that's twice the length of my rod. But also, the fly line is much easier for me to hold than a slick monofilament is when I'm setting the hook or when I'm stripping in slack or fighting a fish. If I'm just holding monofilament, sometimes it tends to slip through my fingers and when I'm setting the hook, especially because we're using fairly thin monofilaments from like 20 down to 12 or even some guys are fishing straight 6-pound type leaders. And so having a little bit of grippiness to that fly line there really helps during that function. But you want the lightest fly line possible so that it doesn't sag in between your guides or out your rod tip, because that sag will not only bring your rig back towards you and kill your drift and cause drag, but it also will kill your tactile sensation of takes and some of the sensitivity you have within the rig. So typically you're looking for a line that's as thin as they make them. There's quite a few companies that are making them now. I tend to fish the Cortland Competition Nymph line that they have a level 22/1000ths of an inch line. That happens to be the cutoff for a fly line in FIPS Moosh, so everybody's making them to that diameter. But I fished that one. Rio has a Euro Nymph line. A bunch of other companies have jumped on board and made a Euro Nymph line, and they really do help out when you're out on the water, European nymphing. So I suggest that.
Because you don't really, with European nymphing, you never really have the line on the water, right?
No, you don't. And not when you're, when you're fishing a 20-foot leader, you'd have to make a very long, awkward cast with that leader to really have the line out on the water.
Yeah.
Most of the time, when I make a longer cast where I'm, putting above a lie and trying to give it a long distance in the river to sink, the fly line might exit my rod tip 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 feet on a really long cast. But most of the time, you're making casts that are no more than 30 feet, and you're really not actually in the fishing part of your drift, usually any further than 20 or 25 feet away. So you don't tend to have fly line out your rod tip.
Right, right. And then what about the reel?
The reel, you know, like a lot of trout fishing situations, the reel is not super important from a, you know, a drag stopping or whatever standpoint. You know, you're not battling tarpon or something where you're going to burn up a reel. So as long as you got a decent drag in case you run into a nice fish, what you're really looking for in a reel is two things. First, you want a fairly large arbor if you can get it, simply because it's going to decrease the memory in your leader and cause you to have to stretch it less, you know, when you're moving around in between spots and you might reel up again. Second, the reel is most important is the weight, and mainly because unlike when you got a 9-foot rod and especially with today's rods that are so light, and they're not tip heavy if they're, you know, 9 feet or shorter. But when you get a longer rod, that 10, 10 and a half, or 11 foot length, you have a more mass that's extended out away from you, and so that rod becomes more tip heavy as the longer it gets. So you tend to want a reel to counterbalance that weight so that it balances in the cork, and that will really save you a lot of fatigue in especially your forearm. And during the cast, it takes a lot of the effort out of it to have to stop that tip heaviness of the rod at the end of the cast. So if you can have a reel that balances well with that rod, then that's what I look for. And each rod's going to have their own balance point with their own weight of reel, but you tend to want a little bit heavier reel than you would for a three-weight, for instance. Like if I'm fishing a three-weight rod, I'll most of the time put somewhere between a five- and a seven-weight reel on that rod, especially if you're looking at a lighter machine reel to balance that rod. So that's what I look for in a reel.
So you may not need a special reel, just maybe take your 5-weight reel, put another spool on it with a new line and
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Kind of check that out, see if it balances out for you, okay?
Yeah, and in fact, all the time when if I'm teaching a clinic or whatnot, I just tell people that grab an old reel
that
they don't really care about,
yeah,
a lot of times those older reels tend to weigh more anyway.
They put them to good use.
Well.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, we've got some. So the really kind of important thing to talk about, we had a lot of questions on, is you know, the line, I mean the leader tippet, and you know how you rig all that up. Brian Adams in Bakersfield, California says, describe your favorite leader setup for Euro nymphing. So can you walk us down the line there, so to speak?
Sure, and if you're more interested in kind of an in-depth review on this, I've got a couple of posts on my blog that talk specifically about leaders. But in the film, I list one leader setup, and it's mainly a leader setup that is kind of a do-all European nymphing slash I can fish a dry dropper on it slash whatever. And it's also the easiest leader for people who are getting in the European nymphing to use because it's easier to cast than if you were to go lighter. So that leader, I start with somewhere between 10 to 12 feet of 20-pound Maxima chameleon, and chameleon really tends to be pretty important for the butt section of the leader, mainly because it's stiff for one, so even if it's used some of the thinner pound test or diameter versions of it, you still get good energy transfer. And two, when you stretch it, it loses its memory really well. So some of the other butt section materials out there really tend to retain a lot of memory. But if you give a chameleon a good stretch, it'll get straight. So I start with that 20-pound test of 10 to 12 feet of that. Then I use some sort of transition material. My teammate, Pat Weiss, he really likes Suffix Elite I think it's a 14-pound test that is out there that he uses for that. You can use Amnesia, you can use Strand Gold, you know, something like that. And that transition material is usually about 3 feet long. And I like something that is colored like that, like Suffix Yellow or Strand Gold, simply so that you have a little bit longer material that you can still use as a sider if your sider's on the water, and it can help you pick it up if you're having a hard time seeing it. And those materials also tend to be a little less stiff, so they kind of dissipate some of that hard kickover energy that you're going to get from that long flat butt section. And the flat butt section is designed that way basically so I don't have knots in it that are catching up in the guides, although a tapered leader with some action. It still works really well. And my partner in the film, Lance, he has a tapered leader that people can look up there. And then added to that transition material, that suffix or your amnesia, you have a cider. And so most of the time what we use is cider these days. There's all sorts of companies that are making pre-dyed monofilaments. So they're dyed a lot of times in a bicolor format. So they'll have like an orange, yellow, or a red, orange, red, yellow type configuration so that essentially in any light that you encounter outside, whether it's sunny or you've got glare on the water or whatever, you can pick up one of those colors. And that cider is essentially Euronymphing's version of a strike indicator that you're watching for a take. Attached to the end of that, you can either continue to taper your leader or you can put a tippet ring on there, which is what most people will do. And that tippet ring can stay on the end of your cider so that you just add your tippet to it and you don't cut back into your cider. And typically a 2 millimeter or smaller tippet ring is what I like to use. And then I'll use 3 to 5 feet of the tippet to my first fly, and I will add another 2 feet for my second fly, but I will do it by, if you take that initial piece of tippet that's 3 or 4 feet long or 5 feet long, and you go to the end but then come back up about 6 to 8 inches, I will tie a triple surgeon's knot there. And that long tag that's coming off, that longer piece that's facing down towards the end of your rig, that becomes the dropper for your top fly. And then you just tie your fly, your second fly on that piece of tippet below, and that's your point fly. And when you tie on that surgeon's knot, you want to cut off the upper tag that's facing towards the rod. If you were to use that tag, in my experience, it pulls through the knot and can send, it can basically cut through your knot and cut your strength down. So you want to use that piece of tippet that's facing down towards the end of your leader. So in total, you're looking at a leader that's around, 19 to 20 feet by the time you add a 12-foot butt section, a 3-foot transition, 18 inches of cider, and then your tippet.
Okay. A couple questions on that. Scott in Portland asks about, is there a way to dye or color tint nylon or fluorocarbon tippet material? He wants to tie in cider sections with his own tippet material when crafting his own tied leaders. He says he's not interested in purchasing colored monofilament. Do you know of any method to do that?
I don't. And okay. The ciders that are made these days are so good that No, to me it's very much worth ponying up a little money and getting some proper cider, because the other thing that you'll notice about most ciders that are made today is they're dyed to be opaque, and that opacity really helps you pick it up when you're looking up at it in front of the water. It kind of forms a silhouette in addition to being bright. So I don't know the exact process they use to dye the cider, but it really does help, and I suggest that people, get a dedicated cider material, because especially if you're fishing a thinner cider, it's hard enough to pick up on its own, if you're not used to it. I think it'd only be more difficult if you use something that was not as good.
Bob Garman, Philadelphia, he wants to know about proper use of the Curlicue leader system. Do you use that, or do you steer away from it?
The Curlicue, it's funny. There was a few years there where the Curlicue just kind of blew up. One of the championships back in the early 2000s, the French team came up with this Curlicue to fish in this really low, exceptionally clear, spooky water that they were fishing, essentially so they could cast it upstream a long ways of distance and use that Curlicue as a little suspension device or indicator that would float their rig for a while with a really light fly. And all the Curlicue is you can make them, you can buy them. It's essentially cider material that's wound into a really tight, it's like a slinky, essentially, that retains that slinky shape. And so you have a bunch of contact points on the water that you can grease, and it floats for longer. Personally, I don't use the Curlicue pretty much at all. I used to carry around them in my hip pack. For my own style of fishing, I either just grease my cider and fish a little bit thicker cider specifically so that I can grease it and float it upstream for a longer period of time, or I kind of form a hybrid rig where I will tie a tag a little ways below my cider where I use a light dry fly, like a, you know, smaller caddis type pattern or parachute type pattern that still floats well but doesn't hold up a lot of weight, and I can kind of, and it doesn't make a big splash either, like a big foam, you know, type dry fly or something like that. I can do a little bit of an in-between type system there by fishing a dry dropper off the same leader, but avoiding that curlicue. To me, the curlicue catches a lot of wind, and it forms a weird hinge in your leader, and also forms a little bit of, you know, a slack, essentially, when, because that has to straighten out when you set the hook. Mm-hmm. So it's a little too much shock absorption to me, and I tend to miss fish if I'm using it high-sticking-wise. And I just don't, I don't like it all that much. But I will say this, it's very easy to see for a lot of people, so especially if you've got some eyes that are challenged, seeing just a straight cider, it can be a good thing to try for that. But there's other ciders out there to help with that as well. There's like glue drop ciders where they put little drops of glue along the cider that are bright. You can also use you know, some furled or backing type ciders that weigh more, so they're not as good at holding off the water, but they're very visible. So there's other ways to deal with that, but The curlicue to me is a niche cider that I would really only use in very specific circumstances on like a really flat tail out or glide that's moving very slow, and I'm trying to float, you know, light flies a long ways away upstream.
Question from Jerry in North Carolina, kind of not to use to tie flies to the tippet material.
That's an easy one. Basically since my junior year of high school, I have used the 16-20 knot. I've messed around with a lot of knots over the years, I don't know, probably 6 or 8 different fly connecting knots. That's the one I always come back to. For my tippet ring, though, because of the way the 16-20 knot sits, it has to turn over when you cinch it. And if you have the eye of a fly, you can manipulate the angle of your tippet so that it does that well. But if you do it on a tippet ring, sometimes during that process, the knot actually folds around the back of the tippet ring and cinches incorrectly, and so you got a bad knot. So I tend to use a double baby knot for my tippet ring, but I've had a fair amount of slippage issues if you don't dial in the right gauge of wire with the right size of tippet on the baby knot. And so I don't tend to use that for my flies, but I go to that 16-20 knot instead.
Davy as in Davy Wanton?
Yep, correct.
Yep. Okay, maybe not. Yep. And let's see. Here's one, Tony McBride in Kansas. He says, Devin, when Euro nymphing, will you use a strike indicator or cider? Well, you already talked about the cider. Is there ever a call to use both? I mean, in particular presentations or?
Yeah, well, so like I was just talking about, in certain situations, especially slow water that's smooth that you might not be able to approach fish very closely, or when you have like knife edge seams in like an eddy where you want to, you know, keep something rolling around in there, a lot of times I will use a strike indicator, but I'll use it in the form of a dry fly. So I just use a dry dropper, but I'll still use it on that Euro nymph leader.
Okay. So you can use the same rig, you just add that in.
You can use the same rig, absolutely. Yeah. That's another one. I have a blog post that I talk about battling wind with a Euro leader, because if there's one thing that's the Achilles heel of the Euro nymphing, it's a really windy day because it blows your leader all over the place. And so you do tend to need the contact with the surface of the water that a strike indicator or a dry fly can give you when on a windy day, or, you know, in those smooth instances where you need to be able to cast and fish a little bit further away. And so I'll do that with a dry fly, and that works really well. And the dry fly comes off the water much cleaner than most indicators do. So I spook less fish by, you know, when I'm setting the hook with a dry dropper rig, a small dry fly especially. Most of the time, if it's heavy enough or deep enough water that I need to use, you know, I would have to use an indicator or a big dry fly to hold up that amount of weight. You can usually approach fish in those situations to fish them without the use of the indicator and just Euro style, either tight lining, you know, up and across or down and across.
Okay, let's move on to flies. Jerry in North Carolina wants to know, do you ever use micro streamers?
all the time, and macro streamers, if you want to call them that. I carry around a box that has micro streamers and macro streamers, or articulated flies aren't allowed in competition, but I still carry them for, especially when I'm targeting, big piscivorous fish. I have a lot of bull trout rivers around me here, and so I'll target them with streamers all the time, and I'll do it on a Euroleader. The thing about nymphing or drifting streamers on a Euro rig is you can pick all sorts of pockets exceptionally well, little hidey holes where big fish are tucked up behind a rock or under a log or whatever. You can, micro cover all the different seams and pockets that with this rig. That is one thing about this rig. It's exceptionally thorough at covering, micro niche water types. And so streamer fishing works very well with it in those instances where you can jig your streamer right off the face of a rock or right behind it instead of making long casts and just stripping it through, kind of glancing over water types like you might do swinging flies through. You can drift in specific holding water with the streamer on the Euro rig. So all the time, yeah, I use streamers all the time on it, in addition to just fishing streamers in other ways as well where it's called for it. But certainly on a Euro rig, you can fish streamers.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see here. Oh, this is good. Ted in Northern California, what are the advantages of using a weighted Euro-style nymph versus a standard weighted nymph versus a standard nymph with weight added to the leader?
Okay, so I get asked this question a lot. There's a lot of folks out there that either use, a drop shot type rig with their split shot below unweighted flies on the tags, and you hear arguments back and forth for why one or another is good all the time. And certainly each rig has some variables that make it desirable. To me, if I were to have my rules taken away from competition right now and I could fish any way that I wanted, all the time, I would still fish with weighted flies the way that I do. And there's a couple reasons for that. First, it's a direct connection to your flies. So most people don't realize just how many fish are taking in your fly and spitting it out very quickly before you even have an idea that there's been a take. And that can be the case whether you're Euro nymphing or indicator fishing, but especially when you're indicator fishing when there's slack in between. But having those weighted flies, like I was talking about at the beginning of the program where I let them form the contact for my strikes, those weighted flies give you that nice direct connection to your flies, or to the flies that provides detention for strike detection, so you get better strike detection. In addition to that, if you're using a drop shot type rig and you have unweighted flies above on tags, unless your tags are really short, I find that with unweighted flies, they tend to wrap around the leader a lot and they don't come unwrapped. So you can have a fly that looks like it only has like an inch long dropper because it's spun around the leader a bunch of times. And so essentially it looks like you have two pieces of tippet coming off the front of your fly. So there goes your nice, 5 or 6 or 7X tippet that you're fishing to try and have lightly weighted or, a light tippet for a good drag-free drift or, to avoid tippet shyness from fish. Beyond that, I think one of the most important parts for me is I can go back and forth between all sorts of different water types with very little changes and make sure that I'm fishing them the most efficiently possible. So if I'm fishing a drop shot rig and I go up into a riffle that's only 10 inches deep, and let's say I hold that rig off the water, but I've got 10 inches between my split shot and my first fly, and then I've got another fly above that.
Mm-hmm.
If that
yeah.
split shot is down near the bottom, those flies are up out of the water, or they might be
yeah.
in the surface themselves. But by having those weighted flies on the end of the leader, I can fish ultra shallow water and have my flies still down near the bottom in the taking zone, and then I can go straight back to a pool or a deep run and do the same thing without changing my rig, without changing my leader. All I have to do is change the angle that I fish and maybe the cast that I use, whether I might use a cast specifically used to get tight right away if I'm in shallow water with a horizontal type cast where I have tension at turnover so that from the minute it hits the water, I've got strike detection. But then let's say if I get to deeper water, I can tuck cast those nymphs to get them down into a deeper part of the calm. And I haven't had to change the rig at all. Those weighted flies have done the job for me. And instead of crimping on and off split shot constantly, if I do need to make a change, all I have to do is tie a different knot, to another fly.
Yeah. So when you, you had mentioned this earlier, when you're tying these nymphs with weight, and you mentioned you're not necessarily tying them heavy like they used to be in the Euro-nymphing world, what is your method for adding weight to the flies?
Sure. Well, let me clarify that first point. So when I first started European nymphing, I was doing what was effectively thought of as Polish nymphing at the time, because Vladi, a former world champion, was our coach for Fly Fishing Team USA. And a lot of the flies we were using had, like 4-millimeter tungsten beads, and then they had a double wrapped shankful lead. So they were 20-grain flies a lot of times. I haven't used flies like that really in years for the most part, other than in really, niche circumstances. But most of my flies these days, I would say 80% of the time I'm fishing a fly that's got somewhere between a 3.3-millimeter and a 2.3-millimeter fly, or a tungsten bead on it. So a 3.3, 2.8, or 2.3-millimeter tungsten bead. And then typically I have a couple of wraps of lead wire behind the bead, both for a little bit of extra weight and to lock the bead in place so the bead doesn't spin. And on a slotted bead, I'll use that weight to actually prop up the bead and essentially invert the fly if I'm fishing a straight chain hook instead of a jig. So that core range, that 2.3 to 3.3 millimeter range, is where most of my flies lay. And then I do have a few, much smaller flies, 18s and 20s, that have just 2-millimeter or 1.5-millimeter tungsten beads. And then I have, some bomber-type flies for really heavy water where I have 3.8 or 4-millimeter beads and some weight. But really, that core, center range is where I do most of my weighting and my fishing.
So are you doing, are the flies you use conventional patterns other than the bead? I mean, is it a beadhead pheasant tail? Is it a beadhead prince nymph? Is it a bead, are you trying to match the hatch, or are they, as Roger in Cheyenne, Wyoming wants to know, is more for attract on the attractive side or more on the imitation side?
Well, it's interesting. I think if you were to look into most competitors' fly boxes, you wouldn't find all that many flies that are strictly imitative. And there's a really important reason for that. We go and in a single tournament, like if I go to a world championships, I might fish 3 rivers and 2 lakes, or I might fish 5 rivers, if it's an all-river tournament. So if you go to 5 rivers and they're all very different rivers, you have to know a heck of a lot ahead of time to be able to find a fly that's imitative of the exact insect that you might, come in contact with. And then you might come into a situation like I did in my first session in Bosnia a couple of years ago, where I had 5 separate insects that came off during my session. And so it's really inefficient, for one thing, to only fish flies that purely imitate one insect. In my mind, it's usually more effective, except in, blanket hatch situations on a river that you're really familiar with. But it's more effective to have flies that are either attractor-type patterns or impressionistic-type patterns that can look like a lot of things. So if you looked in a typical competitor's fly box, you'd see a heck of a lot of hare's ear and pheasant tail variations. They might be very significant variations, but there's a lot of hare's ears and pheasant tails being fished out there by competitors who are catching a heck of a lot of fish on them. And then on top of that, we use a lot of, flies that are attractor type or junk type patterns, as a lot of guys call them. Flies that have a lot of flash or pizzazz or fluorescent colors or just action built in, like, something like a squirmy wormy or an egg pattern, those grab me patterns that have pulling power, where if fish are into that sort of thing at the moment, you can pull them further out of their lie than you can with, some size 18 Betis nymph that has got to be right in front of them to eat. So, yes, a lot of the flies that I fish are conventional, but a lot of them have European influence. I fish a lot of flies like Perdigone nymphs or Tag nymphs, that are very popular in, you know, in the competition scene in Europe, and they're popular for a reason because they work. So a lot of my fly boxes over the last 5 years or so have gravitated towards a lot of European influence. But yes, mostly impressionistic patterns with attractor patterns thrown in, and then the occasional imitative fly for when I, you know, notice there's a big hatch coming off, or for when we only sample a certain, you know, insect in the drift or something like that.
So we're not fishing too many midge patterns here, are we?
I get asked that question a lot too. I mean, it is hard to build in a lot of weight into a midge for sure, and a lot of people will kind of fish midges still on their rig, but they'll obviously fish them in tandem with a heavier fly that, you know,
can bring it down,
gets them down essentially.
But
one of the things I've noticed, other than this time of year when, you know, midges might be the only thing on the menu, and other than in, you know, very specific tailwaters that get a ton of pressure, I catch a lot more fish on different fly patterns, you know, larger fly patterns than I do on midges. And that's if I'm fishing them in, you know, in combination. And even in a lot of the tailwaters that I've gone back to that I grew up on, or that I, you know, that I visit when I'm fishing elsewhere, tailwaters that if 10 years ago I'd been there, I would have, you know, gone out there with my indicator rig, and I would have gone out there with my size 22 to 26 midges. And I go there now, and I fish, you know, larger flies along with some smaller flies, and lo and behold, my larger flies a lot of times end up catching a lot more fish. So sometimes I guess the variety, especially in a pressured river where they see so many of those flies, having something to shake it up can work. It can work really well.
It's always the opportunistic trout that says, hey, that's a meal. I don't care if it's midge day. I'm eating, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
And probably you're getting more on those as well because of the presentation you're doing that is more natural and and getting down to the fish, right?
Yeah, well, as most, I think, most better anglers will tell you that the presentation is more important than the pattern. And you could give a really good angler, you know, the quote-unquote wrong fly, and he's probably going to catch a lot more fish than the angler who only thinks that the fly is what is the difference between catching fish and not. So certainly if you're fishing your flies well and you're getting a good drift and you're presenting them well and detecting strikes, then you're going to catch fish regardless of whether you have the perfect fly pattern or not.
The what about fly patterns? Is there a good resource out there or book or your website or a place where one could go to find patterns to tie?
Well, certainly.
The European ones, the European ones you were talking about a while back?
Yeah, well, you know, you can actually surf a lot of European websites and find some fun pictures that will give you some inspiration. I have a YouTube channel as well as tutorials that I write about the fly and kind of the history of it and how I came about it on my blog. So if you are a fly tier and you want to mess around with some new things, I have tutorials on my website on the blog there. And I kind of go through a lot of my confidence patterns that have become strong, you know, producers for me in competitions over the years. And on our at the end of our film, we have 14 confidence patterns as well, 7 of mine and 7 of Lance's. Just kind of flies that we've become reliant on through competitions, and you'll see most of those are not very imitative, but they're more impressionistic or attractor type patterns. So you can find them in our film, and beyond that, like I say, I surf a lot of, you know, foreign websites, a lot of different companies, like fly producing companies. If you go to their websites, they have great pictures of flies a lot of times. You can get some inspiration there of some different patterns and try and, you know, replicate them yourselves, and then you can often be surprised at what you find.
Okay. Daryl in Wheat Ridge asked a fly tying and organizational question. He says, I'm very curious how you visually know what weight of the fly is once it's been taken off your rig. If you were to look at any random fly of yours, would you be able to tell the weight components of that fly? You know, he says, with tungsten heads, brass heads, underbody, weight of differing amounts, it can get crazy. Would you have a fly box by weight, thread color? You know, how do you sort those out?
Thanks for that question, Daryl. I'm pretty sure this is Daryl Eakins, who so I've been corresponding with a little bit over the last little bit. And thanks for that question. So it's a really good question here. Let me tackle the first part. For those of you who may have read George Daniel's book, Dynamic Nymphing, which is an awesome book if you haven't read it, there's a photo with a caption in there. The photo is of me at one of the world championships that George was with me at, and we were around the team tying table that night, and I was weighing flies. And I have a little grain scale, just like a powder scale. It's a digital little deal that you can get for $20 or $30. And a lot of times I'll organize, especially I used to just organize my boxes by weight, pure and simple. I just had a heavy box, a medium box, a light box, or, you know, might have graduated into four or five at the end of there. But that's how I did it to begin with. Over the last little bit, I've kind of started streamlining my process where I don't have as many variations within the same bead size in weight as I used to. Most of the time, I try and replicate weights so that I know what's going on the end of my rig, and I know how it's going to affect it. So I do that by changing the bead size and then keeping essentially the same number of wraps of the same size of lead wire for that size of fly. And so I've kind of memorized over time what sort of grain weight that produces. And then as far as my box organization goes, these days I have it broken up by a more broad category of fly. So I have one box that has just tag nymphs and waltz worms in it. And I've got one box that's entirely dedicated to perdigone flies. And then I've got another box that has all pheasant tails and all hare's ear type variations on the other side. And then within those double-sided boxes, or single-sided if you just had one category in there, the top of my box is my lightest patterns, and then, you know, there's rows that have all that weight of pattern, and then there's rows that have a medium weight and a slightly heavier weight, and then the heaviest weight. And I can usually just see that by the bead size, but then if I need to know something more, like I have in some of my heavier flies where I do have some more variation in the number of wraps of lead, then I'll draw some lines in the box with a little note out to the side of the grain weight, and then I know, you know, these couple of rows are this grain weight and these couple of rows are that grain weight. But in general, especially when you're starting and you want to make it simple, start with your bead size, use the same number of wraps of lead of the same size, you know, for that size of fly, so like all three wraps of 015 lead on a size 16 fly with that size of tungsten bead, and then just vary the size of tungsten bead and match the size of wire to your hook, and you're good to go. You've got your categories of weight. Just arrange them by those within your box, however it makes sense, whether you have a heavy, medium, and light box, or whether you have categories like I do now, and you've got a system.
Okay, sounds good. Couple of questions from Doug and Lake Ontario and Dino in Michigan. They're both asking about using Euro-style nymphing on other types of fish other than trout, such as rough fish, you know, steelhead, carp, bass, panfish. Have you tried the techniques on other types of fish?
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I fish for steelhead a lot. You know, I do a lot of swinging when they're in the larger rivers in the fall, but around me, the steelhead tend to get into slightly smaller rivers around this time of year or into the spring, and so I almost exclusively Euro-nymph those areas, and I have a couple of blog posts specifically about Euro-nymphing for steelhead if you want to go check those out.
Right.
And then I've certainly caught a lot of other fish when Euro-nymphing. Around here we have a lot of pike minnow, we've got pea mouth, we've got chisel mouth, we have all sorts of different interesting cyprinids that are in the Columbia River system here that all of our rivers drain into, as well as smallmouth bass. And one of the project that I run that I'm a biologist for, we have a screw trap that's down low on a river that's near where it goes into the Snake River. And so when I'm down there and I'm working, I'll fish a lot of times after we're done working for the day. And during steelhead season, there's usually steelhead and trout in there, but by the time it gets to the end of the season, a lot of warm water fish have moved in. So I'll catch bass, I'll catch pike minnow, all sorts of stuff. And I'll do it a lot of times by switching to streamers, like we were talking about. And I'll nip, you know, a bugger or some sort of streamer on the end, or larger flies like stonefly patterns and things like that, that some of those fish that are maybe a little less micro bug focused but a little more macro bug or bait fish focused will capitalize on.
Okay, Doug up in Calgary, Alberta, asks, what type of water best suits your own nymphing?
I would say that about 75% of the water out there that you'll come, you know, into contact with, and especially most higher gradient streams, is very good for Euro nymphing. It really excels in any water that's broken. So if you have rocks that are creating any sort of surface disturbance, then it's exceptionally good at that. It's really good in pocket water, really good at shallow riffles and runs where you got, you know, broken water. Where you might tend to run into some issues, at least fishing up and across or just directly across from you, are in water types that are smooth and shallow that you can't, you know, approach nymphs or approach fish very easily without spooking them. So that's in those water types, you either need to turn to some sort of, you know, dry dropper rig like I was talking about, or you know, hunt indicator rig at distance. Or you need to grease your cider and float it upstream so that you have an upstream presentation where you're not spooking fish. But I would say in general, if it's moving water more than, you know, just creeping along, then Euro nymphing is probably going to work pretty well there. If it's really slow and you need something to hold your flies off the bottom for a long period of time, then you're probably better off either fishing that dry fly on a Euro leader or, you know, just going to an indicator type rig.
Right, right. Yeah, and there was a question later on from Larry Eden in Colorado about shallow water, him finding it not effective, and you kind of just addressed that. That is a situation.
Well, shallow water, if it's moving, a Euro nymphing is exceptionally effective in. In fact, I think that's one of the water types where it kind of showed me how much I was missing in. I catch, especially during the summer when the water temps are good and fish are spread out and they're up in shallow water, I catch a ton of my fish these days, a lot of them during the summertime, in very shallow, you know, riffles that are inches deep a lot of times, barely deep enough to cover trout's backs. And that's a water type that without a Euro rig, where I can hold my rig up off the water and control depth without having to move an indicator around or whatnot, but I can just hold my cider up further off the water or grease it and make a horizontal cast. Those are water types that I can fish really effectively now with a Euro rig, where if I didn't have it, I would struggle, and I used to just pass by a lot of that water.
Oh, wow. Okay, so there you go, Larry. Don't give up.
Don't give up, because it's a water type that you'll learn to catch a lot of fish out of if you, you know, learn to fish upstream, for one thing. That might be a bit of a struggle. If you're used to just Euro nymphing across the river, then, yeah, you're going to struggle in shallow water a lot of times because you're going to spook fish before you catch them.
Yeah, yeah. So talk to us a bit about general presentation techniques. We've got so many questions left that I want to try to cover as much as possible, and I thought maybe if you just talk about, you know, your approach, you know, to a run and how you do the presentation.
Oh, that's a good question. That's a hard question. Well, one of the things we get when we're competing at the beginning of a session, we have a half an hour where we get to look at our beat and set up our rods and decide how we're best going to fish the water that's in front of us. And that's a really crucial time where you got to make a plan. And so I'll look at the water in front of me, kind of decide, like we were just talking about, what water types, you know, benefit or you know, are more attuned to a certain technique. And then I'll usually fish them in a progression. So when let's say I come into a run, and I've got a nice shallow edge on the near side, I've got a deep slot down the middle, and then I've got another shallow edge on the far side, on the far bank. What I typically will do, especially in a run-type situation, because you tend to have those very specific depth contours as you go across the river. I'll start with a light rig, maybe a, you know, it all depends upon the river and the depth and speed of the water that you're in. But I'll start with a light rig and fish directly upstream on that shallow edge of that run. And I might, if it's, you know, a really clear river or something where I need to be stealthy, I'll fish from my knees and just fish all the way up that run with that size of weight or that amount of weight so that I fish that type of water and that depth of water the best I can. Then I'll circle back around, re-rig with a slightly heavier fly, and target that center zone of the run. And usually then, instead of fishing directly upstream, I'll be casting up and across, you know, 45 to, degrees up, or maybe even a little shallower angle. And I'll be casting 10 to 15 feet a lot of times above that deep center lie. And I'll put the lie that I'm targeting essentially perpendicularly across from me or just slightly downstream, because typically when you're fishing up and across, your best drift with a Euro rig is, you know, 20 degrees above you to 20 degrees below you. So I'll cast a ways up, let my flies get to depth. While they attain tension, I'll lift my rod as the rig is coming towards me and take in slack if I need to, so that I get to that point where it's just tight enough that I can detect strikes, but I'm not affecting the drift. And then I'll use that rod to track, but not necessarily lead, my flies through the drift, through that, you know, taking angle from 20 to degrees above me to 20 degrees down. And if anything in that drift signals a strike, any deviation in the sight or, you know, hesitation, anything weird, an angle change, whatever, I'll set the hook. If not, I'll let it continue to drift down, and as it gets below me, I'll intentionally let it swing up, and a lot of times you can get some fish on that swing up. And then once I fish that center, if I can wade close enough, I'll probably re-rig, get a little bit lighter again, maybe like I did to begin with on the lighter side of the run, and I'll fish that far side of the run on the bank. Most of us fly fishermen miss a lot of fish by not targeting fish that are hugging banks, because we think they're all in that nice deep water with the color change in the center. And while there are a lot of fish out there, we miss a lot of the ones that are tight to cover or under branches, under rocks, things like that on the bank. So covering both banks as well as that sexy looking water, that nice deep, you know, riffly water in the middle, is a good thing to do. Let's see. If I'm in a pocket water situation, a lot of times you can just kind of keep the same rig, and I'll zigzag back and forth across the river a lot of times and just hit each likely looking pocket in a pocket water type situation. Pools all tend to target fairly similarly to runs, except that in those slower pools where you have a smooth surface, I will grease my slider a lot of times if they're not too deep, and I'll fish the tail out first by doing that. And then once you get up into the gut of the pool, into that deeper part, a lot of times you'll fish up and across and perpendicular to your lie, just like you would in a run. And then in riffles, that shallow type water that I was talking about, my first option is, if it's not a very turbulent riffle, if it's just a smoother type riffle with a little bit of bounce to the water, then I'll grease my slider and I'll float it. And if it's a deep riffle, then I'll use kind of a vertical tuck cast where my flies drop vertically down and my slider lands on top of them, and that'll give them enough slack to get down to depth at the beginning of the drift so that then you're at depth throughout the rest of it while your slider's drifting. But if it's a shallow riffle, then I'll use a more of a horizontal type presentation where my leader lands tight and my flies are far beyond my slider so that I have tension right away. And in those really shallow riffle situations, that's where a lot of people miss a lot of fish, because their rigs aren't tight the minute they hit the water. So a fish eats your fly, spits it out, and you don't even know that he ever ate. So in those really shallow riffles, having that horizontal rig or cast is a good way to go. Or if they're turbulent enough and you can approach them close enough, then I'll just hold my slider off the water a ways and instantly have tension from the minute my flies hit the water in that shallow water so that I have strike detection right from the get-go.
Yeah, so when you're, you know, you make a cast, you know, like you said, maybe 45 degrees up upstream. The line hits the water, your leader goes in. you keep talking about greasing the cider. Are you always floating the cider, or is your cider many times in the air? What's the difference between high sticking and the way that you present with your own nymphing? Maybe that's a better question.
Well, the up and across type Euro nymphing presentation is very similar to what a lot of people would think of as high sticking. It certainly shares a lot of the same variables in the way that you would present a fly. So if you make that quartering upstream cast, during the first part of the drift, you're either going to stay tight so that you have strike detection right away, or a lot of times in deeper water, like I was talking about, I'll give it just enough slack that my flies can drop and get down near the bottom. And as that's happening, I'm raising my rod, but I'm not tracking the rod downstream very much. So I'm just raising it so that I can get it to the angle of the leader that I want. Typically, that rod tip is about eye level or slightly above, and my shoulder is raised and my arm is extended. So essentially, I look like I've got a flat arm and rod, like the rod is just an extension of my shoulder and my arm all the way out into the river, slightly tinted up angle. And that's going to give you your longest reach, and you can keep the cider off the water during that drift. Because the cider tends to be thicker tippet than or thicker leader material than your tippet below, it's going to catch more water. It's going to, grab more water in the surface if you have it under the water. So if you have enough tippet tied onto your leader to get deep enough in a run, I tend to fish my cider off the water so that I don't get it caught in those surface currents, which are usually much faster than the currents at the bottom. So
basically, you're trying at all times to keep from the line from the tip of your rod to the fly as straight as possible?
Straight with a slight bow to it. So if it's so straight that you have a direct line,
weight on it. Yeah.
You either have too much weight or you're leading your flies faster than the current. Typically, if you look at a lot of the footage we have in the film of our ciders, there's a slight kind of bow or, J hook, whatever you want to call it, right at the end near the cider where it's starting to enter the water. So you've got just enough tension that if a fish takes, it shows you right away, but you don't have so much tension that you're pulling your fly faster than the current, or you're fishing such heavy flies that, it's a direct, tight, tight, tight vertical presentation. So there's a little bit, just a tiny little bit of a curve in that cider. And a lot of times that when that curve straightens out, that's your indication of a strike.
Yeah, your take. Well, Devin, we've run out of time. we didn't run out of questions. So I'm going to put you on the spot here and say, hey, will you come back again and maybe we can do part two?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
It might be a month or two down the road, but we had so much interest that I hate to leave all these questions hanging. And But if you'd be willing to do that, we'll set something up after here and then promise everybody we'll be back and talk more about this because very interesting, and you've got quite the book of knowledge to share, so I really appreciate that. All right. Well, good. We'll set that up with you later. Stick with me, Devin, here. We're going to give away a few prizes tonight, so hang with me because we're going to be part of that, make sure we get the right answer on these questions. So we'll come back in just a minute, and then we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and a copy of Devin's new film on DVD, Modern Nymphing, European-Inspired Techniques. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout found anywhere. The pebble mine remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org to learn more and to get more involved. That, again, is SaveBristolBay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away some of our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register tonight, it's too late, but make sure you do so for our next show. You don't want to miss out on your chance to get some of these incredible prizes that we have to offer. And if you are the lucky winner, then we'll be contacting you after the show by email, asking you for your information, and so that we can get these prizes off to you. Give me just a second to get organized here. Okay. And okay. So the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation, the International Federation of Fly Fishers. And let me hit the go button here and see what we have. Okay. Gary. And it looks like we've got a winner here of Gary Brower. Gary Brower. And Gary is in Colorado. So congratulations, Gary, and we'll get in contact with you after the show. And our second, and by the way, to find out more about the International Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Good organization to support and be part of, and so get involved there. And next, we are giving away a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And our winner there is, let's see, Edward Hovsepian. Hovsepian? Ed, you know who you are in Massachusetts, so we'll get you that that subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Sorry I destroyed your name, but I have no idea how to pronounce that. There's probably three ways I can think of at the moment. So, anyway, thanks a lot for you guys for playing, and I hope you enjoy your prizes. So let's take a look and see if we can get a winner here for Devin's DVD or the online streaming version, whatever. Can they get either whatever they want here, Devin?
Yeah, so I'll just get a, you know, if they get in hold of me, they can either choose the hard copy or we have a digital download as
okay.
well.
Okay. Okay, good, good. Okay. All right. So question is, real simple one. What knot does Devin use to tie his flies to his tippet? What knot does Devin use to tie his flies to his tippet? And I'm waiting here. And I think I got a winner here. Let me just check real quick. Let's see here. Paul Adams in Farmington. He says 1620. Is that what I was looking for, Devin?
That's what you were looking for.
Okay, okay. We got a winner then. So, Paul, send me your information. You can use the same text box that you were using to answer the question. And just give us your address there. I do have your name and email address. And also say, do you want the DVD or do you want the access to the streaming? Well, it's streaming plus they can download it. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, they can can stream it if they got web, but they can also download it and have it, you know, on a jump drive or whatever they want.
Yeah. So let us know which one you want, and then I'll pass that on to Devin, and he'll get that out to you. So thanks, guys, gals, for playing tonight. I appreciate it. I hope you enjoy your prizes, and thanks for listening so carefully. Devin, I really appreciate you being on with us. Just a wealth of information poured out of you tonight. It was, and I'm sure a lot of that has to do with your fly fishing background as well as your biology background with working with fish so much, and it really comes across. Thanks for sharing.
Oh, absolutely. I tend to get a little excited when I talk about fish or fly fishing, so I'm sure, you know, that might have come out too.
That's okay, Devin. That's okay. We all do. You know, if we didn't, we wouldn't love it so much, right? So
that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, and I'll get with you next few days about setting up another time to do part two. How's that?
Okay? That'd be great.
All right.
That sounds great.
Our next broadcast would be on February 15th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, I'm going to be interviewing John Olsch, and our topic for the show will be a passion for permit. John has been fascinated with fishing the saltwater flats for almost 40 years. He's caught just about every kind of fish on the flats, but he's obsessed with permit. He studied the permit inside and out and is one of the most knowledgeable permit fly fishers on the planet. Join us to learn more about fly fishing for one of the most challenging fish in the water. We'd like to thank International Federation of Fly Fishers, the Motto Books, Tarpon Key Lodge, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. I hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing. Bye.